today to an interview series with outstanding professionals. I'm Stephen Ibaraki, and I'm conducting an exclusive interview with John Kleinberg, 2008 ACM Infosys Foundation Award recipient, past multiple awards recipient, 2008 Discover Magazine's 20 Best Brains Under 40, 2005 MacArthur Fellow, member of the National Academy of Engineering and the American Academy of Arts and Sciences, internationally noted Cornell professor and researcher, celebrated teacher. John, you have a considerable history of outstanding contributions in a number of fields. Thank you for sharing your considerable insights, deep expertise, and wisdom with our audience.
Thanks very much. I appreciate the opportunity to talk with you.
So when did you hear of this extraordinary honor, a recipient of the ACM Infosys Foundation Award? How did you feel at the time, and what was the reaction from your colleagues and from your family?
Let's see. So I guess I was contacted by the chair of the committee for the award shortly before the award was announced publicly. And, of course, it was a great honor to receive the award. It was a great honor to be in the company of the first recipient of the award, the inaugural recipient in 2008, Daphna Koller. And I guess I was also very grateful to the ACM and the Infosys Foundation for the commitment that they're making to supporting and recognizing fundamental research in computer science. And the response from my family, my friends, my colleagues in the community has been very positive, and I certainly very much appreciate all the good wishes I've gotten from them.
Well, that's really fascinating. So, I mean, it's great that you've got sort of all this sort of groundswell of encouragement and support and so on, and I guess that goes into this next question. If you can describe your journey into computing from your youth up to the present, and what were some of the foundational lessons did you learn from this journey, and why were you initially attracted to computing?
Right, so, I mean, I guess my interest in math and science comes from early childhood, probably, since my parents were both scientists and conveyed, you know, often just through example how exciting it is to go about doing science. With computer science in particular, so I'm part of the generation that was sort of in junior high school and thereabouts when the Apple II and personal computers first appeared in the early 1980s. And I think a lot of us were excited by the ability to create new things, and how there was this technology that really allowed both for somehow simultaneously mathematical reasoning and also creative expression. And I think that's something that's always been a source of attraction for people to the field of computing. And I think as the technology continues to change, you know, I think it's important that we work to keep that source of excitement there, you know, as we get into new generations of students.
So going on from there then, what were the major challenges that you faced during your career? How did you overcome them? And what challenges still exist today? And can you outline others that are new?
Sure. I mean, so I'm someone who has certainly benefited enormously from mentoring at all stages of my career. So initially from family and friends and from teachers in high school and so forth. And then, you know, a series of really strong mentors when I was undergraduate, when I was in grad school, when I was a postdoc at IBM, and also here as a, you know, when I was a junior faculty member at Cornell. So, I mean, I think one thing I've come to appreciate throughout my career is how science is really an enterprise that involves a community working together and really trying to work to bring new people into the field, because in the end, research is a very challenging activity, and it's something where it very much helps to have access to a community of people who can help and mentor in that way. And so in that sense, I've been very fortunate. And you know, it's also important to understand that this is something our field, and I think a lot of fields of science, need to work on. That you know, we need to make sure that really we drop in a diverse body of scientists, you know, a diverse population of students, and try to eliminate sources of bias that prevent people from having access to these opportunities.
Well, you mentioned that you did some studies with IBM. Can you go into more detail about that?
Sure. So this was actually in the year between when I got my PhD in 1996 and when I came to Cornell. Cornell was nice enough to offer me an assistant professor position and then allow me to take a one-year leave at IBM, where I worked with Prabhakar Raghavan and his group at the Almaden Research Center. And that's really where I began working very actively on the question of web search and more generally how we can take algorithms that operate on networks and use that to help us understand how information is organized, how it's organized on the web, and how people access it more generally by taking advantage of its network structure.
So can you tell us more about your vision and objectives behind your current roles, and what do you hope to accomplish and how you'll bring this about?
Sure. So at the research level, I think there's an ongoing thrust within computer science to recognize that over the past 15 to 20 years, computers and computer technology have really taken on an important role in connecting people to information and to other people. And so as a result, when we think about large-scale computational and information systems, we have to think about them not just as technological systems, but it's really things that combine technology with social structures and with the mass in interactions of large numbers of people, and we have to study them on those terms. And that's going to inevitably involve interaction between, for example, computer scientists and social scientists, with economists, with sociologists, and we see that going on. And I think that's a very exciting and long-range research direction. At a more general level, I think a lot of the consequences of these developments have been massive changes in society, bringing about lots of benefits, and also, of course, posing new challenges as well. And so I think, you know, in this way, computing has been having a huge impact on the world, and we need to be attentive in the research community to what these emerging challenges are and think about ways of working with them.
So it sounds like you're sort of talking about computational concept. And I guess the whole idea of multidisciplinary studies and sort of integrating the whole computational side and...
That's certainly true, right? Right. I think that what's happening is because computing has become so central to so many different areas that we're seeing computer scientists working with people in the physical natural sciences, in the social sciences, in the humanities, and in the arts, and you know, with the media, with government, and I think, you know, with policymakers, I think this is a very positive development, and it really shows how as computing infuses itself into all these different areas of intellectual, public, and social life, that we're going to need to train new generations of computer scientists more broadly to be able to work at these interfaces.
You know, you're talking about training scientists and engineers and sort of encouraging sort of, you know, the proliferation in a sense of, because it's so important and critical to the success of individual countries, the world, and so on, sort of this fabric that's out there. And what are your comments in terms of investment in science from the government?
Right, so I think it's very important to keep up a significant level of governmental investment in science through things like the National Science Foundation and through other government agencies that fund and promote science. And if we look back at a lot of the innovations in computing over the past 40, 50 years even, many of them have come out of basic research going on at universities being funded by federal funding for basic science. And I think what's important to appreciate is that really game-changing research and really significant breakthroughs are very hard to predict in advance. And so a strategy that I think has worked very well has been to maintain this very, very broad portfolio across the community of different projects and different areas being pursued, many of which often proceed for a long time and then unpredictably yield large breakthroughs that have significant benefits for our economy and for our society.
Well, I guess you'd be encouraged then. I mean, I get the sense from your government in the U.S. that there seems to be some wish to invest in science now, and it's perhaps even being part of the stimulus.
Right. I think that, you know, these are very exciting developments, and the academic community is certainly working to try maximizing the opportunities that this presents us with.
You know, you've received so many honors and awards for your work. Can you describe each and the underlying research and its implications in an overview way?
Well, so, right, I mean, I've been fortunate to receive a number of awards. I mean, I think what it really is, if you think about it collectively, is this focusing of attention on really a broad group of researchers, which I'm a part of, which who've been very interested in this emerging theme in computer science, which starts with core issues in computing, like algorithms, like networks, like information, and then thinks about how the new kinds of online systems that are being built change the way we have to work with all those concepts, and how we can use ideas, fundamental computational ideas to create new applications in this space. So, one of the earlier examples of this in my own work was the work I did on web search, and in particular, taking advantage of link structure and network structure to try identifying high-quality information resources on the web. And then subsequently thinking about how the web in the end is not just a network of information resources, but it really reflects networks on the people who create that information. And as a result, one has to bring in social network analysis. And in the end, think about how the massive amounts of data we have on social interaction suggests new kinds of models that we can then validate on the data.
Are you able to talk more about, let's say, the prize you received from the International Mathematical Union?
Sure. So this was the Nevin Linna Prize, which is awarded, I guess, every 4 years at the International Congress of Mathematicians. And there's something that they've been giving out since 1982, which was created, I think, to recognize the very, very tight connections between mathematics and computer science. And in particular, to recognize the work going on in theoretical computer science, which has worked on models of computation, the design of efficient algorithms, and the limits to efficient computation. And it's generated a large number of ideas that have gone on to inform many applications in computer science. And so in my case, and this was in 2006, I think the award was in particular recognizing the work I'd done on algorithms which operate at this interface between networks and information, which exploit network structure to understand the properties of large collections of information and ultimately also the networks on the people who are creating that information.
Well, it's an amazing selection. I mean, you know, when I look over your career, the NSF Career Award, the ONR Young Investigators Award, fellowships from MacArthur, Packer, and Sloan Foundations, and so much more. It's just so remarkable. Well, with so many honors for your work, how do they contribute to your vision for business and industry, governments, academia, media, society, technology, and internationally?
I mean, I think one thing which awards can do, I guess, is focus attention on a particular area or topic. And I've certainly tried to use the opportunities they present to help try to inform people about what it is that computing has been able to accomplish in society and for the economy. And in the end, to try, you know, using those opportunities to spread ideas of computing to a broader audience. I think it's also, I think awards like this also help create connections between academia and the industrial world, which is one thing that functions very, very well within computer science, that many of the ideas going on in academic computer science are able to have an impact on the industrial world. They're often incubated in academia through federal funding, but there are many channels that allow it to inform things more broadly.
Can you tell us more about your work concerning the web?
Sure. So this is the work I was mentioning earlier about how to take advantage of link structure and network structure to organize information. And so this was work I was thinking about very actively in beginning around 1996. Looking at the fact that the web at that point was about 6 or 7 years old, it had been really extremely popular and sort of had achieved considerable public awareness for the past 2 or 3 years at that point in 1996. And yet, web search was still this very, very challenging problem. So when you thought about web search, there was this first generation of search engines, things like AltaVista and other search engines, which approached web search essentially as a text retrieval problem, right? So in fact, we should note that the availability of web search engines so quickly after the creation of the web is a nice example of the power of basic research that reached back several decades. In this case, drawing on work by Jerry Salton at Cornell and a number of other people working in the area of information retrieval. And that provided tools for thinking about web search. The problem was, of course, that on the web, we didn't have a controlled collection. We weren't searching, say, a collection of newspaper articles or scientific abstracts written by professional authors using a controlled style and a controlled vocabulary. Rather, on the web, the whole point was that anyone can be an author. And conversely, anyone can be a searcher, right? So you didn't have to have special training in order to execute web searches. You were just presented with a box and you could type some words in. And so this explosion in diversity of both content and also search intents made the problem of web search very, very challenging. On the other hand, we had something working in our favor, which is that it wasn't just a collection of documents written in text. Rather, it also had this network structure provided by links, right? So the fact that an author had created a link from one web page to another indicated some kind of endorsement, some kind of latent message that the author of one page thought this other page was important. And when you synthesize these links in aggregate, you can begin to make estimates, not just about which documents were relevant, but which ones were the most definitive or authoritative on a given topic. And so some of the work I did in 1996, along with work that a number of other groups were doing, work going on at Xerox PARC, work going on at Stanford, obviously, by Brennan Page and a number of other efforts, all were seeking to exploit this idea that the hyperlink structure of the web encoded a large amount of human annotation as to which documents were significant or important.
Your achievements demonstrate your work as founder and international leader in social network analysis. Can you share more about what this means?
Sure. So, I mean, I should start by saying, of course, that social network analysis is an area that reaches back quite a long time and has been a very active area in sociology and anthropology and in a number of other disciplines in the social sciences. And so when computer science began thinking about this in the late 1990s, we had a lot of expertise to draw on. And so there's sort of two issues going on here. One is, why were computer scientists drawn to this? And I think the point there is that once we started thinking about the web and the information content of the web, you inevitably realize that the web is created by people. And these networks you're observing are really a reflection of the social networks on the people themselves. So even prior to the advent of social networking applications, right, things like Friendster in 2003 and Facebook in 2004 and so forth, the web already, even in the early 90s, was encoding a lot of social structure that really hadn't been visible before then. And so it made it inevitable that computer science was going to have to think about these social network issues that sociologists have been thinking about for a half century or more. The second point, though, is that because of all this data, the kinds of social network questions that you ask when you look at it from this computational perspective are related but somewhat distinct from what sociologists would ask. Namely, we have this explosion of data. So rather than looking at networks on, say, 100 people in a high school or in a small company where we would gather the data by interviewing people and you would know what each person, who each person was, what each link meant, here, as computer scientists, we were collecting social network potentially on 1 million or 5 million or 10 million people. And so it was very hard to know who any one of these people were, what each link meant, but in aggregate we could begin to see properties that were genuine but were invisible at these smaller scales. And so really I think the interesting challenge now is to try to combine these two threads of research. One, the social science thread in which the data sets tend to be smaller but the questions can be more complex and nuanced, and the computer science side in which the data sets are very large, there are a lot of new algorithmic and probabilistic models, and the question is, can we use that as a vocabulary for scaling up the kinds of questions that sees in the social sciences to this new kind of data.
I see. So do you see sort of extensions into predictive markets or sort of sensing the underlying kind of consciousness of what's happening worldwide?
Well, I think there are some very interesting opportunities to try to look at the aggregate behavior of many, many people and try to synthesize some kind of an overall signal out of that. And there's even work that some of us at Cornell are doing now with my postdoc, Gary Leskovich, and my student, Lars Backstrom. For example, we've been looking at trying to build maps of the news cycle, right? So trying to collect all of the news articles and blog posts produced every day as provided to us by tools like Spinner, and looking at quotes and phrases and memes as they spread through the news and blogosphere, and what those look like as they evolve across time. In a sense, what is the world collectively paying attention to? We've been doing a similar thing, and this is work with Dave Crandall and Dan Huttenlocher and Lars Backstrom, looking at large photo sharing sites like Flickr, synthesizing all of the image content, and not just the images, but the textual tags and the geolocation information, to try to find hotspots of activity, and to ask, again, what's the world paying attention to here in the case of what landmarks are people drawn to, how do they view them, and can we essentially create maps just from the raw digital traces of people's behavior on a site like this?
So really, you're really profiling now, or I get to sense your current research and some of its challenges and opportunities implications. Can you talk more about this?
Sure. So my current research is looking at these kinds of questions, right, these kinds of questions of aggregate behavior, looking at things like news and like geolocation and images. I think any of these systems where large numbers of people are collectively creating information, one other domain that we're looking at that has these properties is Wikipedia, which is both a giant knowledge repository and also essentially an online social system to coordinate the work of millions of people. And so I think there are some interesting themes here. One is that in aggregate, these large collections of information can produce very, very interesting patterns and collective traces. Secondly, that these social effects are going to become important design principles for big information systems, right? So Wikipedia or Flickr or blogging, or any of these other systems we think about, Twitter or Facebook or YouTube or Dig or, you know, or all these sites have both technological and social mechanisms working together. And so I think as computer scientists, we're going to need to think about design principles that incorporate both of these. And ultimately, those design principles are going to be expressed, I think, in an algorithmic and mathematical language. And a final interesting question, of course, is that by its very nature, research about large stockpiles of information are going to raise questions of privacy. Namely, we have the traces of behavior of many, many people, much of it carried out in public, but often not really carried out with a sense that, you know, that what they're doing is being recorded and is leaving traces. And I think as time goes on, people are increasingly becoming aware of this simply through the increases in media coverage of these issues, but we still have a long way to go to really have people thinking fully about what the privacy implications of all these online data sets are. So that's something that we've been looking at from a research point of view, but in the end, it's not only a research and not only a technological question, it's really a societal question, and I think a lot of people are going to have to be engaged in a broader conversation about what we want and expect in terms of online privacy.
I see. So, but I can also see sort of commercial applications, governmental applications, threat sensing applications and so on, because you're sort of sensing what's out there from a group think standpoint, perhaps.
I mean, I think there are applications in all those domains potentially. And again, you know, I mean, I think what's interesting again is how much one can do, you know, because the kinds of things I've been talking about here are information you can get from a crawl of the web, right? So essentially this is something that already was striking in the mid-90s that, you know, it's not as hard as it looks to go and collect huge amounts of data that's sitting on the web. And when you put that together, you do get these aggregate pictures of what people are talking about and what people are interested in.
Sounds like the current state of IT is changing to reflect sort of this point of singularity that Kurzweil talks about, and sort of this merging of man and or humans and computers. So that's sort of kind of like one, like in the movie The Matrix, and it kind of ties into swarm theory and Darwin and survival of the best ideas. And you see that with Dell, where they have this site called Idea Storm. And do you see more of these kind of implications?
I think these raise very, very interesting questions. And I think this is because a lot of these systems are very new, the research questions around them are correspondingly new. And it's going to be interesting to see where all of this goes. It has certainly led to a conception of these, of the interface between people and computers, which consists not only of one person interacting with a computer, but really groups of people interacting with computers, right? And again, if we think back to something like Wikipedia, it's really not just about the interaction of any one editor of Wikipedia, but about the way the system actually facilitates the creation of social structure and norms within the group that allows productive work to be done.
You know, sort of going on another tack now, you're dubbed the rebel king by your students, so how did this come about?
Right, so this actually, it's an anagram of my last name, first of all, is the etymology of it, I guess. But this dates back to a discrete math class for computer science majors that I taught in fall of 2000, so now approaching 10 years ago, which is when this first started. It's persisted somehow, you know, over a number of years now. And I think, you know, I mean, one thing that I always think of, you know, in thinking about this is how it's a reflection of the fact that Cornell students, you know, in addition to working very hard, also tend to have fun, and not just fun outside their classes, but even sort of work fun into the classes that they're taking. And that's one of the reasons why it, in turn, is so much fun to teach at Cornell also. I mean, it's a very enjoyable experience and a very intellectually stimulating one also.
You know, when you sort of profile or sort of research what you've done, you know, there's this sort of, you're known as a great teacher. You know, so you're a great researcher, a great thinker, an innovator, a leader, and you're also a great teacher. And you have this amazing course on networks, which is drawing students and has been have for some time. Can you tell us more about this course on networks?
So the course on networks, which I've been co-teaching with David Easley in the economics department here, I think was in part created to try conveying to students some of the ideas that we've been talking about. The idea, and this was certainly, I think, one of the main goals that David and I had when we first taught it, was to convey this idea that for thinking about the parts of the world that are really highly interconnected, one needs simultaneous perspectives from computing and mathematics, from economics, from sociology, and from a number of of disciplines really that have thought about highly linked structures and also the way in which the behavior of one person or one group can affect the outcomes of everybody, right? So when we think about connectivity in the world, we think about both at this network level, I'm linked to you, there's a social network, there's a computer network, but also linkage at the level of behavior. What I do causes things to happen in unexpected ways. And we see that even now in settings which aren't explicitly, you know, where the network is more latent, right? So the current economic crisis, for example, can be viewed as a breakdown of trust in a network of economic and financial relationships. And there are many, many other examples that point to the fact that the world is now very highly connected, and there's a collection of tools for thinking about this, but they're spread across many, many different fields. So the challenge for us in teaching this was that although all these ideas are out there, and we felt they were really important even at an introductory undergraduate level for people just entering college, the actual discussions of them were taking place in research papers and other sources that weren't really accessible or even readable by people at an introductory undergraduate level. And so a lot of the effort that went to the creation of the class was to take a lot of these ideas and try to convey them at this level in a way that we could have a single course that brought all of these ideas together.
You know, it sounds like it'd be a great idea to have a NOVA program on this course, or doing a video for YouTube or something like that.
No, these are interesting ideas. At the moment, we're trying something much simpler, which is which comes more naturally to us as academics, which is writing a book based on the course, which sort of reflects our attempts to take these research level ideas and describe them at this more general level.
So, you know, you talk about a book. So what do you hope to accomplish with your new book coming out in 2010?
So what we're hoping to accomplish is to take some of the thinking that we've done about how to teach this material, in particular, some of just what we've written about the material, which is designed to not assume as much background knowledge as the ordinary research type discussions of this topic do, and make it easier for other people at other institutions to teach courses like this, so to have it serve as a roadmap, essentially. And I guess also just to have it as a resource for people who may not be on college campuses but are working in an industry to think about some of these issues and to work through them. You know, in the end, I think this synthesis of computing and economics and so sociology is really going to be an important perspective for anyone who's working in the computing industry and is dealing with an audience, right? If you're someplace that's, you know, doing search or social media or advertising, there's this issue of computing technology that interacts with an audience, and that audience will react in complex ways, governed by not just the technological effects, but also by the social and economic effects as well.
Can you tell us about the title of the book?
So we've actually been working on what the title should be, since we wanted to reflect this idea of networks and of connectivity, and also the idea of strategic behavior and aggregate behavior, right? The fact that connectivity also means that what I do affects what you also do, and the outcomes for you. So we've been thinking about titles like networks and strategic behavior that try to sort of combine this notion of structure, you know, the structures that are in place, but also the behaviors that take place on them.
Now, this book is really designed for the academic environment, but to be more accessible, is it going to be sort of like an you know, consumer-based stores, you know, like, so anybody can get a hold of it, and you see really a broad build-out worldwide, including translation to Mandarin and so on?
So we certainly are working on translations of it, and we want it to be, you know, I think these are ideas that are, you know, obviously not just, you know, specific to any one country or any one sort of national focus, but so we've been working with the publisher at Cambridge University Press on you know, how to make this more broadly accessible. It's aiming to fill this intermediate layer between books that have done an effective job of popularizing the notion of networks and network science. So Malcolm Gladwell's book, The Tipping Point, obviously, and Watts' book, 6 Degrees, and then sort of moving that one level up into slightly more technical territory to work out some of the mathematical models, but remaining much, much more accessible than what one actually finds in academic research papers on this topic.
How would you describe your top innovative achievements in terms of the problems you're trying to solve, your solutions, and the impact it has today and into the future?
Well, so I mean, I think, you know, and again, this is really an effort by a large part of the computer science community to try to articulate design principles for this new generation of computer and information systems, which are going to have to take both technological and social effect into account. And the hope is to really allow people to have new ways of interacting with information, new ways of building communities online, and also, ultimately, new ways of grouping together large collections of people to try to accomplish tasks and to try to get work done in a massively distributed way that wasn't possible previously. And at the same time, not just to create these systems, but to build mathematical and algorithmic tools for reasoning about these systems so that we can try try to think in advance about what sorts of systems are feasible, what can be created, and what problems are not going to be feasible.
So how long will it take between sort of the kinds of research you're doing and the innovations that you've done throughout your career, and specifically now your current work, and sort of the impact you'll see on technological solutions that will hit the communities that are out there, the public?
So that's always an interesting question, and it's one reason why it's very hard to think about research and to plan for it is that not only are the different, you know, successes from research unpredictable, right, and there are lots of things I've worked on that haven't led anywhere, obviously, and that's obviously true across the entire research community, but mingled in with all of those are unpredictable successes from research. The other thing is that the time frame is always unpredictable, right, so there can be things that take a very long time to reach fruition. So one example we discussed earlier was Jerry Salton's work on information retrieval, which really the foundations were being built in the 1960s. The public only saw the fruits of information retrieval on a really global scale in the 1990s with the creation of the web, and that in turn built on many, many other forms of technology. So sometimes it can take multiple decades, or sometimes if the time is right and the technology is there, it can happen quite quickly, right? So one sees things being created and then being deployed and being used by the public very quickly. So it's often a question of finding a time when the conditions are right, when there's a public need for it, a public interest in it, when the technology is there. So it's always hard to predict the time frame for these.
You know, considering the nature of your work and your research, are you approached by entrepreneurial kind of minded people and saying, you know, let's partner, let's find some investors, let's start a company, that kind of thing?
I mean, I certainly talk a lot with people in an industry, you know, both at large companies and also small companies just starting out. And I think, you know, one thing about computer science in general and this part of computing in particular is that the bandwidth between academia and industry is quite high. And so I think we have the sense in academia that if we have some idea of something interesting, there are people out in the commercial world who are receptive to this and are interested in, you know, trying things out. And so, you know, so in that sense, I've sort of enjoyed the position in academia where I can be more open about what I'm working on, publish papers, teach, and so forth, and yet feel as though I have this communication channel with what's going on in the commercial sector as well.
You know, you've had this remarkable career. You've got a lot of life experiences. You must have a lot of career tips. What are your top lessons that you want to share with the broad audience?
This is always an interesting question, and this is always a question that I ask people also, you know, to try to watch people as they work and try to learn, you know, from example what works for them. And I think different things obviously work for different people. One thing, you know, that I found quite effective is to try to keep an open mind about many different topics and areas and things going on, right? So to read widely, to talk to people with lots of different interests, because in the end, I think a lot of interesting research, a lot of interesting new ideas happen because you bring together ideas that were germinating in very different areas, and somehow the synthesis of all those can be quite powerful, you know, but in order to see the opportunities for that synthesis, you have to actually be reading things in all those different areas or talking to people in all those different areas. At the same time, and I think related to that is that when these ideas happen, it's always good to give credit to the areas that one's work builds on, because in the end, you know, there are often very extensive roots to any new scientific piece of work, however novel it might seem. I guess one other thing is, in all this, it's important to find things which are actually fun to work on and to have fun working on them. It's much, much easier to make progress on a problem when you're enjoying what you're doing, when you're finding it just innately interesting. And so I think, you know, in addition to finding work that's important, also finding work which just has some personal interest for you and trying to find sort of the combination of those two properties. And finally, as I said at the beginning, I've benefited from a lot of mentoring throughout my career, and I think it's important to pass that on to the next generation and work in a mentoring capacity and in a teaching capacity with new people who are entering the field.
You're at this perfect juncture, I think, in my opinion, and you're sort of the hub of this ecosystem of all of this web activity that's occurring and the social sciences, economics, and so on, demographic changes. Is sort of that perfect storm that Tapscott talks about. Can you make your top predictions for the future, the implications, and how executives, IT professionals, and others can best prepare?
So predictions is always an interesting question. So let me stick to a slightly user question, which is predictions about things that are going to be relevant to science, maybe, and to information technology, since even there it's hard enough. Although I think in the end, predictions about science, information, and technology are going to reach out more broadly also into the rest of society. But I think, you know, certainly if we think about these themes of computing as a mechanism for connecting people to information and to other people, there are a number of interesting emerging directions there, right? So in the case of information, the increasing ways in which we use tools like search and like our own personal information repositories as a kind of intellectual prosthetic, right, in the way in which we actually make extensive use of web information now almost in real time and continuously, I think it's going to have interesting implications for the way just people go about problem solving in their everyday life. Similarly, that kind of problem solving and that kind of prosthetic interaction with these information resources is going to ultimately get built into our software, right? So that I think we're going to eventually be seeing software that, you know, as you carry it around in a personal handheld device, is going to be building statistical models of you and your behavior, right? And we see this happening already, but I think we're going to increasingly be encountering the somewhat jarring experience of dealing with software that knows more about us personally at a statistical level than we know consciously about ourselves. And it's going to be interesting to see how all of that plays out. At the level of people interacting with other people, I think there are interesting opportunities here for people in general around the world to take advantage of the web and the internet to really become more aware of people in different parts of the world and in other cultures. And I think in the end, and this is going to be a slow process, it's going to be a process that has setbacks, obviously, but one could hope that the effect of all of this global communication and global access in information is that inevitably we're going to be bumping into people who are very, very different from ourselves, working with them and into interacting with them, and that ultimately could have very positive effect.
That's interesting. And what would be your views then on web science and the web science initiatives, or and maybe even going into things like the semantic web and that whole concept? I mean, what are your views on that?
Right. So I think web science is a very exciting direction, and and the people involved in that, I certainly consider a lot of the research I'm doing, you know, very much connected to those issues. I think that there's a lot of good thinking there going into the questions of how will we make maximum use of all this information that's being collected, how we make it globally accessible to people, and how will this really help us function better as a global society? And these are very, very important questions, and ones where one hopes that web information and these new web systems are going to be able to contribute something.
Do you have any views on machine learning?
So that's also been an extremely successful area over the past 15-20 years. And obviously when I talk about, you know, using search effectively in your everyday life or software that builds statistical profiles of you, all of these are successes of areas like machine learning, which have experienced huge growth and have really shown a lot of innovation as we've gotten these increasingly large data sets, not just from the sciences, but data sets of our everyday behavior.
You know, if you were to sort of pinpoint it, what are the three top or two top hot points around the world for web research and computing research right now?
It's hard to pick particular, you know, places or groups, because in some sense, I think one of the things about web research, almost, you know, by its definition and because it makes use of the tools it's created, is that it's an area where you see innovations coming from all over, right, and where you see new people coming into the field very rapidly, and I think that's one of the things that makes it an exciting field to work in.
John, you laid many of the pillars for a modern day social networking analysis and web search as one of the top groundbreaking visionary innovators. So how do you wish to continue to shape the world and contribute to the fabric of history?
Right. I mean, so obviously these are, big questions and hard to think about. I think, you know, what I find is exciting is to be part of this field right now at this particular point in time, because I think computing and information is becoming increasingly relevant to really many of society's most important problems, right? So we think about access to education and access to healthcare, right? You know, the world's food supply, problems evolving and energy and the environment. All of these are things where computing information can help to provide creative solutions that the world is potentially going to need going forward. And so I think it's very exciting to be at a point in time where the area you're working in can contribute to truly novel solutions to these kinds of problems.
So you've already touched upon this already. So what do you see as the top challenges facing us today, and how do you propose they be solved?
Right. So obviously some of the challenges were the ones I just mentioned, things like access to education, healthcare, food supply, environmental energy problems. I think another one that is clearly a problem and is sort of harder to articulate in one word, is this issue that we're in this world where what goes on in one place has very rapid and significant effects on what goes on really in many other places around the world. And yet it's not clear that we correspondingly think as much about the effect of our actions and what effects those are going to have globally on other people, right? So how did the way we, the different ways in which we lead our everyday lives, how do those actually have an impact on the world more broadly speaking? And my hope there, really, and this is something I was mentioning earlier, is that computing and information technology, just by the nature of the fact that it's globally connected, it makes information from around the world accessible, and it, in some sense, eases communication and the formation of groups from very diverse backgrounds from all over the world, that it will cause us to simply have an increased number of encounters with people from around the world, to be exposed to viewpoints very different from our own. And again, this is going to be a very slow process. It's a difficult process because it, you know, it's a hard thing for people to do. But the hope would be that in the end, it will sort of achieve a greater level of communication and a greater level of understanding of how our own individual actions contribute to more global outcomes.
And I just sort of triggered this idea in my mind right now as I'm talking to you, is that who do you admire out there in terms of the work they're doing? You're thinking, wow, that's incredible.
Yeah, so, right. That's a good question. I mean, you know, I certainly, you know, at the level of the field I'm in, it's a field where there's been a lot of very impressive pioneers, right? Some of the pioneering figures in the internet and the web, some of the pioneering figures in theoretical computer science who articulate notions of what it means to compute things, what things can be computed feasibly and so forth. And then also, you know, that's in terms of people who are, you know, significantly older than I am, you know, but also a lot of the very, very creative work going on by people who, you know, are either, you know, still grad students just finishing their PhDs and so forth, who are creating very, very interesting things online, right? So the whole advent of social media, which is really in its current incarnation only 4 or 5 years old, and a lot of the very, very creative things that went on into that, the way in which systems like Wikipedia, or online games that get people to do interesting work, as part of the end product. All of these are, you know, examples of the way in which information technology has helped sort of harness the power of people to do productive work. So I've been very impressed by all this work going on currently, and in the way in which it really builds organically on some of the founding ideas in our field, you know, created by some of the field's founders.
What groups are underrepresented in computing, and how can this be addressed?
Right, so this is an important problem that we talk about a lot, you know, in academic departments in computer science, that our field isn't nearly as diverse as it could be, and it's something that I think is reflected in a lot of the sciences. Certain aspects are particularly acute in computer science, and you know, and it's something that we're actively working on. Ways in which we're working on it, you know, it's something which one can take steps at the university level. It's something which also, you know, is useful to see broader societal steps, broader things in K-12 education. It's something that the National Science Foundation is putting a lot of thought into. Here at Cornell, one thing we've been thinking about is broadening the ways of getting into the field of computing, right? So rather than have a single point of entry through an introductory course that, you know, that sort of, you know, has a certain style to it, to have many different kinds of introductory courses working in different styles that can appeal to people with a mix of different possible interests and different possible motivations for entering the field.
If you could name one inflection point in your lifetime or one major decision point where there's a fork in the road, what would it be?
Yeah, also a tough question. You know, I mean, I think, you know, there are sort of a number of things. I mean, some of them obviously, you know, probably earlier than I can exactly remember or, you know, or would be able to articulate things, you know. So things when I was growing up and obviously all sorts of influences that my parents had on me and the early teachers had on me. More recently, I mean, obviously in the mid-1990s, there was there was an opportunity, you know, which a number of us thought about, who were at that point getting our PhDs in computer science, which is that we had been trained in areas like theoretical computer science, artificial intelligence systems, and so forth. And there were these opportunities to apply all these ideas to the web, which at that point was new. It was only, you know, it had only been sort of in the public eye for a couple of years, and it wasn't a priori obvious whether this was actually going to become a sort of huge important thing, or was it sort of a transient thing. You know, and so I think, you know, there was this interesting opportunity that people perceived then, that it's a chance to build a really deep foundation of computer science and try to contribute to something that's new and exciting. And, you know, and I obviously, that was a very exciting time to be working on problems related to the web and to online information. And so that certainly is one point at which, you know, there was sort of a conscious decision on my part to try taking some of the things that I knew and had worked on and using it in this context.
Again, you have this great opportunity to meet a lot of people and around the world, and there's got to be an instant, a story that you can share where you think, That's really interesting, and there's some really interesting thoughts there, and I need to reflect on that. So it could be a pioneer, an icon, and may not be even computing. Something that's where it may just sit back and think, wow, that was interesting.
Yeah. Right. Again, a very interesting kind of question. It's one of the things that's nice about being in a university context that one sees lots and lots of interesting things. I mean, certainly the first time I heard about Louis von Ahn's work on games with a purpose, right? There was something just incredibly sort of creative and intuitively appealing about the idea that you could create computer games people would want to play, and in the process, channel the effort from playing into doing some kind of work that was useful for society, right? So, for example, his recent work on reCAPTCHA, which digitizes books by having people type in words they see. And here it's not so much a game, it's just a sort of way to register for a Facebook account or so forth. It's channeling activity that has to be spent in any way into doing something valuable, like creating online versions of books or newspapers. Similarly, in a more actual overtly game context, his work on labeling pictures by having people type in labels and seeing if they could match the labels typed by someone they're paired with over the internet, which in turn produces labels for a large fraction of the images that are text tagged on the internet. And I think that's, one of many examples of the kind of creative work that goes on with computing information technology, right, where there's this kind of fluidity in the way you can design things and also an ability to draw on a sort of long history of knowledge and research in this area.
Well, we're coming to the close of our interview here, and I sort of turn the tables and ask you, what questions would you ask, and then what would be your answers?
Sure. I mean, I think, there's obviously covered a lot of interesting ground. When people come here to Cornell and visit with us, there's a tradition in our department of, going to lunch with them, having coffee, and then, ask them a number of questions about, what excites them in their work, where they see the field going, and also what lessons we can learn from the style in which they work, that you can adapt to your own experience. I think obviously, you've done a nice job of asking all those kinds of questions. And these are, certainly things that I find interesting in just talking to people across this whole field.
I believe you're sort of in the midst of some kind of a conference, right? You just took some time out to do this interview. So, I thank you for considering your demanding schedule that you came in to do this interview with us today. And we are indeed fortunate that you're able to share your substantial wisdom with our audience.
No, thanks very much. I appreciate being able to talk with you about all this.
I'm Stephen Ibraki, and this concludes our exclusive interview with John Kleinberg, 2008 ACM Infosys Foundation Award recipient, past Mass Multiple Awards recipient, 2008 of Discoverers Magazine's 20 Best Brains Under 40, 2005 MacArthur Fellow, member of the National Academy of Engineering and the American Academy of Arts and Sciences, internationally noted Cornell professor and researcher, celebrated teacher.